halftime, aka intermission.
I am sitting in the morning, the diner on the corner. I am waiting at the counter for the man to pour the coffee. And he fills it only halfway, and before I even argue, he is looking out the window, somebody coming in.
Michelle spots Henry's sneakers as she's putting on her coat. Ted clearly forgot them in the rush out the door with Henry. She's already cutting it close to the start of her shift, and now she's definitely going to be right under the wire. She sighs in frustration, verging on irritation, and debates whether Henry needs the shoes that badly. She'll be the one to get the call later when the shoes aren't in Henry's bag. The school has Ted's contact information, but they pretty much always call her. If she doesn't bring them, she'll feel guilty all day about Henry missing the start of his basketball unit, which he's been so excited about. If she just remembered to put them in Henry's backpack yesterday, it would be nice to not have to think ahead like that. It would have been nice if Ted had just remembered them. Now she feels guilty for a whole different reason. Ted will be very sorry about forgetting the shoes. He'll do sweet things to make up for it, and she'll know he means it, that it's not some act. But what she really wants is to just... Sometimes, she wishes she could just feel what she feels.
It is always nice to see you, says the man behind the counter to the woman who has come in. She is shaking her umbrella, and I look the other way as they are kissing their hellos, and I'm pretending not to see them, and instead I pour the milk.
Ted told Michelle he was a siren after their second date. I can't in good conscience continue asking you on dates without telling you about this, he said, twisting his napkin between his hands. There are horror stories of people abusing their powers, and I don't ever want you to feel like you're in one. I like you, Michelle, a heck of a lot. But I hate the idea of you feeling tricked or convinced to be with me. Ted had looked so agonized by the idea, so disturbed and terrified. She believed him. She made a choice that day, and on so many days after, to take him at his word. Ted hasn't once made her feel that choice was a mistake. He is still every bit the kind, sweet man she met and fell in love with. Ted is wonderful. He's so loving and considerate. He's a good husband and an even better father, and she wouldn't change her choices. But sometimes it feels like she's being subsumed in Ted, that there isn't room for what she wants. She liked it at first, knowing what Ted wanted and exactly how to make him happy. She didn't have to guess at how he was feeling. She was so in love with him, so charmed by him, and he was always most concerned with making her happy. He always wanted to fix her problems, to find a way to make things better for her. Lately, it all weighs her down like a scratchy blanket. She wants to be able to get annoyed at him without feeling guilty about it. She wants to feel sad and angry without Ted trying to coax her out of it. It's gotten harder to separate what she wants from what he wants. That doesn't feel as synced up as it once did. Lately, she can't even tell what's her and what's the siren magic.
I open up the paper. There's a story of an actor who had died while he was drinking. It was no one I had heard of. And I'm turning to the horoscope, looking for the funnies. And I'm feeling someone watching me. So I raise my head.
Michelle gets in the car and makes the drive to school, dropping Henry's shoes off at his cubby and racing out of the building before she can get sucked into a conversation with anyone. Her workday is one stressful moment after another. She's exhausted and annoyed by everything, and Ted is in such a good mood when she gets home that she can feel the bad feelings leaching out of her. It's not a good feeling. I could use a nap, she tells him after dinner. What's wrong? He asks with concern. Can I do anything? Nothing's wrong, she says tiredly, then feels guilty when she can tell Ted's desperate to find out if she's just saying there's nothing wrong when there actually is, if she's okay, and what he can do to make it better. Wordlessly, Ted turns away to take care of the dishes, and Michelle can feel the pull of his draw, calling her closer. It grates like a rock in her shoe, overriding every other feeling and thought. She can't help thinking about how sailors used to plug their ears against sirens to avoid the call, and she feels a surge of jealousy for the peace they must have felt. It's an awful thought, and she feels horrifically guilty. Michelle escapes to the bedroom. She doesn't sleep, but she feels relieved once she's alone in the room, away from Ted's pull. Then she feels guilty again for being relieved.
There's a woman on the outside, looking inside. Does she see me? No, she does not really see me, 'cause she sees her own reflection. And I'm trying not to notice that she's hitching up her skirt. And while she's straightening her stockings, her hair has gotten wet.
When Henry's asleep and they're in bed, Ted remembers on his own that he forgot the shoes. Oh, heck, he says, slapping his forehead. I can picture him now. Did poor Henry have to miss his first day of basketball? He's been so excited. I'm such a scatterbrain. It's okay. I dropped them off, Michelle says. He didn't miss basketball. Ted looks at her with a swell of gratitude and love she can almost feel. Thank you, sweetie, he says, as handsome as he's ever been. I'm really sorry you had to go out of your way like that. Should have been more thoughtful. I'll remember next time. She can't bear to make him feel any worse than he looks. It's fine, Michelle tells him, kissing his cheek and trying to give him a reassuring smile. No harm done.
Oh, Moses, rain, it will continue through the morning as I'm listening to the bells of the cathedral. I am thinking of your voice and of the midnight picnic once upon a time before the rain began. And I finish up my coffee, and it's time to catch the train.
Act 2, Chapter 4. Ted is 14 when he hears his dad crying in the kitchen. He's on his way back from the bathroom, and he stops in his tracks. Ted has never heard him cry before.
I'm sick of it.
Ted knows it's rude to eavesdrop, but he just can't help himself.
I know.
His mom. Her voice is soft, concerned.
What do you need?
I need this thing out of me. Never knowing if people hang around because of the damn magic. Can't even trust a compliment.
Hun, I wish you could see yourself the way I do, his mom says. Who you are has nothing to do with some old, practically dormant magic.
Dormant? If only. God, the way my old man used it. To hurt people. To cause suffering. Ted realizes that his dad is talking about his grandfather. Ted hasn't met him. His dad doesn't even talk about him. Ted's dad makes a sound of misery.
Can't get him out of my head. Been gone a decade and he's still right there. I don't ever want to be anything like him.
You're nothing like him. With all you've been through, you're still a good, kind person. I love you. Ted shouldn't be hearing this. It's a private conversation. He moves away, trying to keep quiet, but his father's voice follows Ted down the hallway to his room.
Are you sure you have a choice?
Ted tosses and turns the whole night, sleep never coming to fully claim him. Ted's not at training, and he hasn't answered Beard's message. Beard hits the call button and listens to the rings with an increasing sense of unease. Ted isolating himself won't do him any good. No answer? Roy asks as soon as Beard has put his phone in his pocket.
Lines!
He shouts to the players. Nope, Beard says. Probably thinks he's a nuisance to everyone.
He is, Roy scoffs. Fucking annoying, getting everyone to care and shit.
Beard bites back a smile. Yeah, it's the worst. Roy nods. Grimaces. Still the best bloke there is. Don't make him like that every day. Beard agrees. Look at him out there, Roy says, nodding toward the pitch and the low-energy players, waiting for a fucking barely comprehensible motivational speech. He clears his throat. If he needs help, I know where you are, Beard says. Then he cups his hands over his mouth.
Let's go!
Ted is incredibly prompt when it comes to biscuits with the boss. So it is that, at 8:35, Rebecca wonders if Ted got stopped a few extra times on his way up to her office. She tries not to think about any other reasons Ted might be 5 minutes late, such as, for instance, the random solo she performed for him yesterday. Little else but the song has been on her mind since. By 9 o'clock, there's still no sign of Ted, and it's the only thing Rebecca can think about. She vomited up all those feelings, and it was too much, even for someone as sweet as Ted. Rebecca had been absolutely mortified when she first turned to discover Ted in the room as she sang. To have shared something so personal? She had quickly felt petrified, as it became clear she could not stop singing. Once Ted had departed, those initial knee-jerk reactions began to fade, first replaced by curiosity, and then skin-deep understanding. Rebecca was left with nothing but the truth at the core of the song she'd been somehow forced to sing. She wants a child. It has therefore been an emotional 24 hours. First came denial and fear. Was she capable of doing this, and on her own? Then worry and doubt, as the logistical aspects reared their head. She was beyond her childbearing years, so how would she even go about it? Opportunity came to roost, as she considered the options available, one of which she'd secured years ago when Rupert categorically vetoed having a child. For some time, she had wavered on the decision about whether to have her eggs frozen, but one comment from Rupert had sent her to the fertility clinic. "Are you sure, darling? You don't have a great track record for knowing what you want." When she woke this morning, she felt only excitement and resolve, and so she called the clinic the moment it opened. This is what she wants. And why can't she do it? There isn't a single reason not to that holds up against the joy she feels at the idea. Ted has not made an appearance by the time Leslie stops by for their morning chat. When she can stand it no longer, she rises to take a look out the window and is both relieved and worried to see no sign of Ted on the pitch. He is absent from his usual spot between Beard and Roy. She resumes her work, but it's difficult to concentrate. At 10:30, she finally decides she will only be able to focus if she checks in, so she sends a message. "I noticed you didn't make it in today. Hope everything is all right. Let me know if you need anything." When she leaves for her lunch date with Keeley, there's still no response from him. She'll check in with Coach Beard when she returns. When Rebecca arrives at the restaurant, Keeley leaps from her seat and dives into the hug Rebecca desperately needs. "Fuck, I miss you!" she shouts into Rebecca's shoulder. "I miss you," Rebecca says wetly. They are almost certainly attracting stares and unimpressed looks, but Rebecca doesn't give a single fuck about it. Let them stare. They hold on a bit longer, and then they finally sit down. After the waitress has taken their order, Rebecca says, "Do you have any idea how quiet it is around there without you? How boring!" "Aw, babe," Keeley says, tearing up. "Three lunch dates a week is not enough. I need to stare at your beautiful face at least once a day." She beams, eyes flickering like she's taking it in properly. "On second thought, all day." Rebecca laughs. "Think those venture capitalists might have something to say about you being so occupied all of a sudden." "Damn! Knew I'd left something out of my contract!" Keeley smiles as the waitress drops off their drinks, and they thank her. "So, how are you?" Rebecca is going to tell Keeley her news, but at the risk of overshadowing their lunch, she says, "Oh, let's come back to me. How did your presentation go? Am I looking at the new PR consultant for Fambassador?" Keeley's eyes light up, and she sets down her cocktail. "It went fucking brilliant. They signed with us on the spot." "Fantastic!" Rebecca shakes her fists in excitement. "I had every confidence." "Thank you!" Keeley glows with gratitude and pride. Then her eyes bug out. Fuck, I almost fainted when I saw the figure they agreed to. I wouldn't let Fatima show me the asking price until after. I just knew it'd wig me out. Very sensible, Rebecca says, with a firm nod. She lifts her cocktail. Cheers. To going after what you want. Yes to that. Keely clinks their glasses and takes a long sip. Then she fixes Rebecca with that very impressive, relentless look of hers. Now, out with it. You are sparkling right now. What's happened? Caught out, Rebecca shakes her head. How do you always know? Off Keely's wide-toothed, knowing grin, Rebecca tells her, I do have news. The life-changing kind. Rebecca takes a deep breath, taking in the joy that starts in her chest. By the time it reaches her face, she's beaming and tears are building. I've decided I want a child. Keely's ecstatic shriek resounds through the restaurant. Rebecca cackles with happiness, and then she settles in to answer all of Keely's questions and to bask in all of her wondrous love and support. Once Keely's paid, put it away! I can finally pick up the tab! They walk out to the car park. Rebecca turns to her for another long hug. She sniffles and clears her throat when she pulls out of it. Don't you dare get too busy for me, she says, only half joking. Never, babe, Keely says solemnly. You're gonna need me when the baby comes. Rebecca utterly ruins her makeup. When she's pulled herself together, she says, Right. See you Thursday? You'd better, Keely says. She starts to turn toward her car, then turns back. Oi, almost forgot. Can you go on reconnaissance for me? Roy was even grumpier than usual last night. See if something happened at training yesterday? All he'd say is that he's never listening to Sam Smith again. That's odd, Rebecca says. I'll see what I can do. Roy is normally so forthcoming. Keely laughs. Open book, that one. She walks backward to her car. Bye. Love you. Love you, too. Rebecca finally slides into her own car with a freshly inspired determination. She is going straight to the coaching office when she gets back to the clubhouse. Something very strange is going on. And she is going to get to the bottom of it. Beard doesn't intimidate easily. He's had too many run-ins with characters of many dimensions and too many close calls. But when Rebecca walks in, he's reminded that there is an exception. Miss Welton, Beard says, shifting from his hunch over spells and enchantments in the 21st century. Coach Beard, it's Rebecca, please, she says. He shifts to stand, but Rebecca holds up a halting hand and leans against the shelf by the window. I came by to check if everything is all right with Ted. Not to make it all about me, but I didn't receive my biscuits this morning. And something very strange happened when he stopped by yesterday. Beard nods. You burst into song. Rebecca stares at him before providing a daunting look of cool assessment. So, am I to understand there is something extremely odd going on at my club involving Ted? And no one thought to bring me in? Beard doesn't cower. Not exactly. But if he hangs his head in regret, it only seems intelligent. Error in judgment, Beard offers. Yes, it was, Rebecca says crisply. Perhaps you should take this opportunity to enlighten me. Can do, Beard says. You ever heard of siren magic? Rebecca's well-sculpted eyebrows knit in surprise. Sure. Old folktale, isn't it? Oh, how did it go? Should you meet a siren on the road, determine if he friend or foe? My mother put a lot of stock in it, which I admit made me rather skeptical. She eyes him. Suppose it's not just a folktale, then? Damn, is she quick. Beard takes a moment to be grateful Rebecca turned away from her plan to destroy the club. World domination seems within her grasp. Not just a folktale. Ted's got siren magic in spades. Current theory is Nate cast a truth spell on Ted, and it interacted with the magic already there. Rebecca is evidently speechless while this sinks in. Finally, she says, Well, that makes entirely too much sense. Of course Ted's a siren. She sounds so fond, Beard has to smile. Rebecca appears to hesitate for a moment before she says, slowly and with an air of vulnerability, I must confess, I don't like to imagine my life if he hadn't entered it. Beard honors that with a bit of quiet, then shares, Don't think I'd have a life to imagine. Rebecca blows out a breath of emotion that Beard feels in his chest. Then she nods decisively. Well then, on a scale of 1 to 10, just how much is Ted spinning out from his tendency toward self-sacrifice? Beard smiles grimly. Oh, the scale's cracking under the pressure. Thought so, Rebecca says softly. Now, what is the plan? Rebecca is a tour de force. Beard likes her. Was looking at how to reverse this thing. Beard taps the book in front of him. There are a few options, ranging from extremely difficult to near impossible. Easiest way requires Nate and Ted, but that's going to be tough with Ted hiding out, and I don't think Nate wants to hear anything I have to say. Rebecca appears to consider that. For a moment, Beard thinks he sees regret in her expression, but it's so fleeting that he might have imagined it. While you visit Ted, Rebecca says pensively, perhaps I should speak with Nathan. Beard nods, bolstered by having a multi-pronged plan in place. Still, I have a feeling this won't be easy, he says. Rebecca gives him a determined smile. It wasn't easy crawling back from relegation, was it? No, ma'am. Yeah. Beard likes Rebecca a whole fucking lot. When Nate arrives at work, his eyes are sore and gritty from his restless night. None of his usual strategies for distraction are working, not when they're up against the utter humiliation of last night, of bearing his heart on his sleeve, of opening his mouth and having it betray feelings Nate could barely internalize, of Ted's fucking pity as he took in what Nate was singing, that Nate doesn't want Ted's regret or anger, but his love and attention and care. Work should prove sufficiently distracting. It needs to. The boys have to work on their pole passing, so he won't have time to think about anything else. There is an email from Mr. Mannion waiting when he opens his laptop. See me first thing this morning. Oh, God. He's going to be sacked. Mr. Mannion hates the job Nate's doing. He thinks Nate is a worthless good-for-nothing. God, maybe there was another story in the papers about how Mr. Mannion hired an angry, stupid, violent amateur. Maybe Mr. Mannion's come around to that opinion, too. It was shocking enough that he wanted Nate to manage his club in the first place. Mr. Mannion must have realized he made a mistake. Nate will be sacked, and then he'll be unemployed. He'll have to declare bankruptcy and move back in with his parents, and his dad will know Nate is every bit as worthless as he has always believed him to be. Nate must have done something. He should apologize for... What could he have done? Nate reads Mr. Mannion's email repetitively for any clue, but it's still frustratingly opaque. And would it kill him to throw a please in there? Then again, please and thank you, they're not the kind of thing a successful, busy man occupies himself with. When Nate knows he can put it off no longer, he's already pushing his luck considering it's 5 past, he gets to his feet and makes his way upstairs. God, he'll never be able to work in football again if he's sacked 2 months in. He'll be radioactive. What should he say? He won't say anything. He can't go in there and start volunteering all the ways he's messed it up. If he did something, he'll apologize. Yes, he'll apologize and do better. Mr. Mannion is not in his office. Nate's heart is racing, but it slows as he takes in the empty desk. Why has Mr. Mannion called him up here if he's not even... The team has training in 20 minutes, and he has work to do before that. Ah, Nathan. There you are. Nate jumps in surprise, turning jerkily around. Mr. Mannion, he says, breathless. Didn't see you there. Too distracted? Mr. Mannion smirks and saunters through the door. Nate hesitates without a direct invitation, then hastily follows him. Oh, no, I asked you here, Mr. Mannion says, leaning against his desk and gesturing to his assistant, Sylvia, for tea, because I wanted to run something by you. Of course, Mr. Mannion. Nate puts his hands behind his back, resisting the compulsion to shift on his feet. Every time he's in this office, Mr. Mannion chooses to lean against his desk, which leaves nowhere for Nate to sit that wouldn't require him to shift past Mr. Mannion on the way to the chair in front of his desk. Nate always ends up hovering, with no idea what to do with his hands. Mr. Mannion accepts his tea from Sylvia. Would you be a doll and fetch Maxwell, love? He asks her. Nate watches her slip wordlessly away to get Maxwell, West Ham's manager of football operations, with the twinge of a feeling he can't identify. He shakes it off as Mr. Mannion sets his tea down. Nathan, I'd like to schedule your annual performance review. Nate's stomach drops. Performance review? Yes. Rupert smiles, threading fingers together over a knee. Nothing to worry about. All perfectly standard. Of course, I'll want a thorough self-assessment of your strengths and weaknesses as manager. Nate nods, heartbeat pounding in his ears. Yes, of course, he says numbly. He just needs to make it out of this office, and then he can... When were you thinking?
Oh, we don't need to schedule it ahead of time, Mr. Mannion says, getting to his feet and rounding his desk to sit down. He opens his laptop and types for a few moments. Without looking up, he says, Perhaps later today, but I may have a meeting. As owner, my schedule is unpredictable, but we'll fit it in sometime this week. Nate swallows thickly.
Wonderful, he says. Is there anything else? I should... Training.
No, that was it. Off you go. Training needs you, coach.
Thank you. Nate turns on unsteady legs and starts to leave.
Oh, and Nathan? Best of luck on Saturday. I trust you'll get us that win we need.
Nate barely takes in any of the walk back to his office. It's like he's walking through water. Once inside his office, he shuts the door and finds the corner invisible to players, and that's when the full shaking starts. He has no clue what the annual performance review for coaching will involve. How can he prepare? And if he fails it, will he be sacked? Fuck, of course he will. He'll be thrown out, and before he's even had a chance to prove himself. The performance review could happen at any point this week. He won't be able to let his guard down for a minute. Even then, if he makes a mistake, and he will make a mistake, of course he will. He fucks everything up. A self-assessment of his strengths and weaknesses? God, he can't think of a single strength right now, only weaknesses. Which one should he identify? He can't say. He obviously has no idea what he's doing. He needs to run training. The players are counting on him. Nate rubs the tears from his eyes, taking deep breaths until he can manage one without a pathetic hitch or sniffle, and pulls himself together to head out to the pitch. After training, the locker room empties out quicker than Nate has ever seen it. Even Hoffman left in a hurry, and he always lags behind. Maybe Nate asked them to do a few too many drills. Maybe he was a bit harsh. He did call them all out for slacking. But he could feel Mr. Mannion's eyes on him, even though he never made an appearance. It just seems like he needs to be saying more and demanding better of his players. Nate spends the rest of his morning and his lunch break working on strategies and playing game footage of Crystal Palace's last few matches. He keeps going, breaking down individual players' habits until his tired, sore eyes are blurring over. God, it's past 4 o'clock. Everyone will have gone home by now. The car park is, indeed, empty. Except for one car. He'd know that car anywhere. Miss Walton? Nate asks when he's reached it. Nathan, Rebecca greets, and she opens the door and steps out with a bright smile. First one in, last one out? Nate shoves his hands in his pockets. He is so tired. Miss Walton, with all due respect, why are you here? Rebecca nods soberly. I'm here to provide a word of caution and a standing offer. Nate looks back at the training facility for a moment. Mr. Mannion will have left by now, surely. Better be quick about it, he says, curious in spite of himself. Yes, we wouldn't want an interruption by my ever-so-charming ex-husband. As a matter of fact, that brings me to my word of caution. Rebecca looks at him headlong. However he might seem upon initial impressions, Rupert is a man who cares only about his own interests. Nate doesn't want to hear this. Rupert Mannion is his boss, and he gave Nate the chance to lead the team. Does he wish, sometimes, that it came with the kind of support he thought he'd had at Richmond? Yes, but he'd been wrong about that, hadn't he? When push came to shove, he didn't matter at all. Mr. Mannion believes in me and my methods, Nate tells her. What matters with Rupert is his performance. At least he knows where he stands. Although, he knows I can lead this team, that I... Nate trails off as the upcoming performance review looms over him. Suddenly, it seems odd for Mr. Mannion to be assessing him already, when Nate has only been managing the team since June. Then again, maybe that's just the way a man as powerful and successful as Mr. Mannion ensures excellence. Yes, he's very good at making you feel special and important, Rebecca says softly, looking past Nate like she's seeing someone or something else. Until he decides you might need a reminder that he's in control of how you feel. He gave me a chance, Nate says, voice trembling unpleasantly, when I had almost no coaching experience. Nate trails off again. He's not talking about Rupert Mannion, is he? Rebecca regards him with a look of understanding. And that seems absurd. How could someone like Rebecca Welton, someone powerful and successful, strong and secure, ever understand Nathan fucking Shelley? Nathan, Rebecca says, I hope you can forgive me for letting time pass without providing you this warning. I didn't want to meddle. But now I realize that it would be irresponsible if I didn't do everything I could to warn you about him. I didn't listen when others warned me. I didn't want to hear anything of the sort. Nate is shocked to see pain in her expression. It's like she's been captured in one aspect ratio all this time, and the screen is widening in front of him. She pulls herself to her full, impressive height. I don't want you to ever feel trapped here with him. So my offer is this. Should there ever come a day you want to leave, if you find yourself under his thumb, fearful or uncertain about how to escape, I want you to know I will gladly be a reference for you, for any employment opportunity you might wish to pursue. Nate is too floored to speak. Why would Rebecca do that? He's done nothing to deserve it. Rebecca opens her car door, then pauses. I spent almost 12 years under his spell. I pray you will make different choices, that you won't wait as long as I did to break free. Nate stands in the car park long after Miss Welton has left. Beard grabs a coffee on the way to Ted's flat. Like any proper Midwestern boy, Ted will have a harder time refusing to open the door if there's a considerate act on the other side. It's more of a Hail Mary than a strategic move. There was no way Beard could have stuck around last night. Not when Ted and Nate so clearly needed to talk without his presence. But he still finds himself wishing there had been another way. Beard is going into this without crucial information, and that never bodes well. He rings the doorbell. As predicted, there's no answer. He tries calling. Also no answer. Gonna have to get creative. Judging by the siren call, Ted's in his bedroom. Beard heads to the window, gathering a handful of pebbles on the walk around the building. Beard starts by throwing one, then two at once, and finally a small, clattering handful. The window opens a few moments later.
"What the heck are you doing?" Ted calls down. "You trying to break the window?"
"If it'll get you to open up," Beard calls back. He gestures with the coffee to drag Ted's attention to it. "Come on, it's getting cold." He means the drink. But on second thought, the ambiguity might help him out here. Ted seems genuinely annoyed, though. "Can't take a hint, huh?" Beard ignores that. "Got a lot of pebbles down here, coach. And I was a percussionist in my high school marching band, so I've got a few non-compulsory songs in my arsenal." Ted shuts the window with a thump. Beard figures that's his cue to get back to the front door. He speedwalks so Ted doesn't have time to talk himself out of it. Ted looks disgruntled when he opens up. "Can a guy take a day off?" he grumps. But he accepts the coffee and holds the door for Beard, who manages to restrain the start of his song. He's grateful for that, because he's pretty sure Ted would have slammed the door in his face at the slightest sign of his powers running amok. "Sure," Beard replies, sinking into the couch, "when the guy's not screening his calls and messages." Ted chooses the armchair instead of the couch. That's as much a sign as any. "I was just taking a day. And then I was going to get right on figuring it all out." Beard crosses his arms over his chest and levels Ted with a look. Key word there being "I." When Ted glances away, that's confirmation enough. "Told Roy and Rebecca you were taking it upon yourself to handle this whole thing on your own. Glad I still got it. Haven't lost my edge." Ted sets his coffee down with agitated fingers. "Roy and Rebecca? Y'all were having a fun little chat about me?" "Yeah," Beard says, emphatic in the face of Ted's sharp tone. "Strange as it might seem, they're worried about you, and they want to help." Ted looks torn between carrying on with his defiant, irritated isolation and being moved. He sticks with the first, clearly not ready to accept reality just yet. "They'll clear out when they're forced to do a musical number for me. As they should." "That what happened with Nate?" Beard asks slowly, carefully. Ted closes his eyes, in evident pain. Beard knows his hunch was correct. Nate had to sing. Whatever song came out, it must have been scary enough to send him running for the hills. Beard holds back a wince of empathy. Nate would have run headlong into the compulsion to tell the truth, and there are a lot of complicated feelings there. Beard can relate. "Don't know how helpful this is going to be," Beard starts, "but it's not necessarily bad
for people to share true things. It is if they have no choice, Ted says flatly.
But how does anyone know they're actually making a choice independently, without being influenced by someone or something? Is that even possible? Beard points out.
Ted doesn't seem to be listening. He's got a hand over his eyes, and he's speaking in an undertone.
My dad used to say this was a gift, that I needed to wield it carefully or I'd hurt people. And that's exactly what I'm doing right now, so he was right about that part. But I'll tell you what he got wrong. This ain't been no damn gift. It's a curse.
Beard keeps quiet. It seems like Ted needs to talk this out.
And he knew it, Ted says tiredly, dropping his hand to his chest. What it was like, not knowing if I'm really connecting with people on my own merits, wondering if all my relationships are a product of the magic, if anyone actually wants to be around me, or if I just make them.
Hey, Beard says, caught off guard, you being a siren's just one part of you. Sure, it's compelling, but the rest of you? 1,000-watt power source. People wanting to be around you has more to do with who you are as a person, Coach.
Ted shields his face again. I can make people stay when they don't want to. I can make them think it's what they actually want. Michelle, Nate.
You don't think Michelle had a choice? Beard asks. Even if you could have somehow made her stay, you didn't. That's not who you are.
Ted looks fearful, like he doesn't want to let go of this, like it's been doing him some good in a way.
Beard presses on. Would Nate have been able to leave for West Ham if you could make people stay?
You can make a suggestion that someone might not realize is coming from you. So yeah, you need to be careful about the impact you have.
But that's not exclusive to you because you're a siren. Anyone can influence people if they aren't paying attention. You take that responsibility seriously because you are a kind, considerate person. And that's why people want to be around you, Coach. Why I want to be around you.
Ted lets out a dry chuckle.
Are you sure you have a choice?
Beard isn't letting this go. His mind's made up. He knows what he needs to do now.
Do you really think I'd be here if I didn't want to?
Since 98, Coach. I could have split. I told you I've known a lot of sirens in my life. I'm not sitting with any of them right now. I'm sitting with you.
Beard stands. I want to be here. And if you don't believe me, then I've got a song for you.
Ted rises with him. Wait, now, Coach, you don't gotta...
Yeah, I know, Beard says sharply. That's the point. I'm here, and I'm doing it anyway.
He takes a deep breath, and instead of the dance beat from before, a string version of the song pours out of him.
Beard's voice hits Ted like a siren song.
I'm going backwards through time at the speed of light.
I'm yours, you're mine, two satellites not alone. Nowhere not alone. A freeze frame of your eye in the strobe light. Sweat dripping down from your brow. Hold tight, don't let go. Don't you let me go.
Ted feels a tug in his chest, pulling him forward. He takes a step closer to Beard to accommodate it. Beard's voice is soft but full of passion. So strong, Ted can feel it sweeping through him.
And I never was smart with love. I let the bad ones in and the good ones go, but I'm gonna love you like I've never been hurt before. I'm gonna love you like I'm indestructible. Your love is ultramagnetic and it's taken over. This is hardcore, and I'm indestructible.
Ted takes another step, heart pounding when Beard matches him.
Hands up in the air like we don't care. We're shooting deep into space, and the lasers split the dark. Cut right through the dark. It's just us, we ignore the crowd dancing, fall to the floor. Beats in my heart. Put your hands on my heart.
The knowledge is suddenly there. Ted doesn't have to hope or wonder. It's just there. The truth of Beard's feelings for him, as substantial as life itself. He feels as certain as he's ever felt about anything in his life. And that propels him forward until he's standing in front of Beard. He knows Beard can feel it too, that the smile on his face belies the same realization.
And I never was smart with love. I let the bad ones in and the good ones go, but I'm gonna love you like I've never been hurt before. I'm gonna love you like I'm indestructible. Your love is ultramagnetic and it's taken over. This is hardcore. Ooh, and I'm gonna love you like I've never been hurt before. I'm gonna love you like I'm indestructible. Your love is ultramagnetic and it's taken over. This is hardcore, and I'm indestructible.
The kiss, if Ted can be so bold, is fucking magic.